That's Donald Byrd and the Donald Byrd Band and Voices with Christo Redentor, from his much acclaimed 1963 album, A New Perspective. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrace Lead, and today we get a new perspective about a very, very important period in our history. We're going to be talking about one of America's deadliest race wars in modern times. It occurred in the city of East St. Louis 100 years ago and was race and class driven. We are joined by historian Charles Lumpkins, an expert on race and class conflict in East St. Louis and in adjoining areas, and in fact, all over the United States. This is one of his specialties. He's with us today to help us understand what was called a race riot in East St. Louis, but at the end of which we actually had hundreds and hundreds of people dead. And Professor Lumpkins, thank you for being with us today. I'm so delighted. You had given us some instruction some time ago about the phenomenon of race riots and race wars in the United States, which have been played down really in the history books, but which are to be understood as the continuing examples of how our society has not yet adjusted to the notions that they extol of freedom and democracy. The book that we'll rely on in the course of our conversation with Dr. Lumpkins is American Pogrom, the East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. And it's a very, very important work, as well as his previous work, which really he built upon in the work I just referenced. So thanks again for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Eutrace. Good afternoon, and where would you like me to begin? I could just start with, what was this race riot, which I term a pogrom, and then I can give in the background of what led up to it and why it occurred in the immediate aftermath. Is that fine with you?
That's a good place to go, a good chronology that we should follow today.
Okay, very well. Okay, I shall begin. As Eutrace said, this is the 100th anniversary of what is normally called the East St. Louis Race Riots that occurred on July 2nd and 3rd, 1917. Now, that was the second race riot, and I'll be calling it a race riot for now before I start talking more about why I consider it a pogrom. But right now, a race riot. It was the second race riot in that city in 1917. The first one was on May 28th, 29th of 34, about 34 days before the July riot. Now, the July riot is most well known, or more well known, I should say, simply because it was horrendous. People were killed. Thousands escaped the city as refugees. We don't know how many were killed. We don't know how many were injured. Okay, the riot began when black folks in a certain area of East St. Louis, the Denver Side section, organized armed self-defense groups to protect themselves from drive-by shooters, white drive-by shooters who were going through that section at different times, mainly in the month of June, shooting at black homes, black-occupied homes, and to, in a sense, terrorism, to terrorize people. So what happened was someone called into the police station on the night of July 1st, saying black folks were ringing a bell at a particular church in that section of the city, Denver Side section, and there was a commotion of black folks going on there, so on and so forth. So the police chief sent four members of the police force down to look at, to investigate. It was an unmarked police car, and two of the four police officers were plainclothes detectives. A fifth man joined them, who was a reporter. While they met up with they met with one of the self-defense armed groups that were heading west down Bonne Ave toward the Mississippi River. East St. Louis, by the way, for folks who are aware of their geography, is on the east bank of the Mississippi River in the state of Illinois, directly across from the city, the metropolis of St. Louis, in the state of Missouri. Okay, so they were heading down towards the river where they heard reports that some white men were molesting one or two black women. They met the five men in the car, met this armed group. The reporter estimated 150 individuals, presumably men, but there may have been some women involved with the group too. Don't know. And there was discussion going on. The black men were not certain who these men were. Were they drive-by shooters or were they police officers? Even though it was identified as such, and of course, the two of the police officers who had some type of uniform on, well, they weren't sure if they were true police officers or drive-by shooters in disguise. One of the plainclothes men, it was unfortunate that he was killed in that encounter because he was identified as someone who was really, really really concerned about helping black folks. So he said, "We're with you. We wanted to work with you." But no one wanted to hear it and so forth. Tensions were already high, which I will explain in a moment. But when the driver decided to turn the car around and move and start to drive in the opposite direction, some people said the muffler backfired. Some sound was made that sounded like gunshot, and the armed men, the armed self-defense group, fired towards the vehicle. They killed the man outright. The plainclothes police officer, the second police officer was seriously wounded. He died later with his wounds. The only one of the occupants in the vehicle who escaped without any wounds, injuries, whatever, was the reporter. And so he was able to file his report later that day. Okay, so what happened was someone got a hold of that car that was riddled with bullets and parked the car in front of City Hall. Passersby gawked, of course. The people who were orchestrating this were spreading the news. Now, some white folks who knew black, who had black friends, called, or if they met them on the street, said, "Don't go downtown. There will be trouble. The people are talking about a riot, talking about going after black people." Some individuals made phone calls to various African-Americans they knew, telling them, "Don't go downtown. Stay away. Something's happening." Now, we have to remember, for a good month, perhaps 2 or 3 months, the local newspaper was screaming, I shouldn't say screaming, I'm dramatizing it, but had headlines or articles saying, "Will East St. Louis have a race riot? Will East St. Louis have a race riot?" And that continued even after the May riot, these headlines, these announcements, and so forth. So things were building and building and building. Sometime in the morning, late morning hours, some ringleaders say, "Hey, let's have a meeting to talk about what we should do." And the meeting occurred at the Labor Temple. I mention that because that led many people to believe that labor unions were involved. My research states that labor unions were not involved. White workers generally were not involved, but they're going to receive the lion's share of the blame for the riot. But I will talk about that later. Now, whatever happened, the signal was given by around noontime to start attacking black people. Most of the black people who were attacked, who were wounded, injured, killed, lived outside of the Denver side section of East St. Louis, where the predominant black neighborhoods were. Either they were black passersby in small groups or as single individuals in the downtown district, or in a basically mixed race neighborhoods to the west of the downtown district, between downtown and the Mississippi River. The Mississippi River was lined with railroad yards and such. So it was a mess of neighborhoods and commercial and industrial establishments in that area, west of downtown. That's where most of the black folks who were killed, injured, wounded, and were burned out of their homes or fled across the Mississippi River to St. Louis, Missouri. So the assaults continue. Some white assailants try to make forays into the Denver side section, but there was gunfire from the black residents who were armed, and I'll explain how they got their arms in a moment. So word was out, really, don't go down there. But in the other areas of town where African-Americans lived, in mixed-race neighborhoods or they were just walking through the neighborhood, the downtown area, they were easy targets. The police department was split. I don't know how split it was during the July riot. During the May riot, they did protect black people to a police officer. But now, with knowing that two of their men died from an encounter with a black defense group, the idea was, why should we protect them? Now, some stayed true to their duties. Others went rogue and joined with the assailants who attacked, injured, wounded, killed black folks.
At the end of it all, what are we looking at in terms of numbers? Because this turned out to be a pivotal event, a very, very serious
issue. It was pivotal in a number of ways. The number of killed, the official number given is 49, 38 black men, women, and children, and 9 white men. Now, obviously, the local people, black and white in East St. Louis, disputed the local figure. They did say many put the number much higher, perhaps around 100 black folks. Some people said more, just as many white folks were killed. We don't know. We just don't know the numbers. Newspaper reports went as high as 500 individual black men, women, and children were killed. If more were killed, where did they go? Where were the bodies deposited? Some people said that they were burned beyond recognition, vaporized in the fires where homes were set ablaze. Others said they were thrown in the local Cuyahoga Creek that runs on the west side of the downtown district. Cahokia Creek flows into the Mississippi River. So others said bodies were thrown into the Mississippi River. Others say that they were buried in unmarked graves, hastily buried. We just don't know. But it was horrific by all accounts because of the savagery that was that the assailants shown to the various assailants. I mean, the various black folks that they meted out their vigilante brutality. And even non-black non-residents were attacked. There's a story about a family of four, husband, wife, son, daughter, returning from a fishing trip to their home across the river in St. Louis. And they were attacked. Husband and son were dragged off the trolley, followed by the wife and daughter. The husband and son were killed. The wife was badly beaten, but she was rescued by a brave ambulance drivers. I say brave ambulance drivers because in some cases, assailants pointed guns at ambulance drivers and threatened to kill them if they dare take wounded black wounded to the local hospital. But in this case, the assailants did not threaten, or if they did, the ambulance attendants nonetheless put the wife into the ambulance. When she woke, she was unconscious, but when she woke up, she found that she was lying next to her dead husband and dead son. The daughter escaped. How she escaped, God only knows, but she escaped and got back home in St. Louis in one piece. But that gives you an idea that the assailants did not spare people by age or sex. It's just whatever they felt like doing. The main attempt, if I go by the words of one of the major real estate businessmen in the city of East St. Louis, Thomas Canavan, He basically said, we wanted to turn East St. Louis into a white man's city. In other words, a sundown town, which was very common in parts of Illinois and in other states, north and south, where the idea was that black people should not remain in a particular jurisdiction that is a sundown town after the sun sets. Well, they shouldn't live there. They shouldn't even have a job there if the job requires them to work after sundown. So, but that didn't happen to East St. Louis. Okay, so,
this event, this macabre and terrible event, how did it fit into the general tone, the general relationship that blacks and whites were having at the time?
Okay, the big overall picture is this. The industrializing United States, which was going through much social turmoil to begin with massive immigration, so on and so forth, and the imposition of Jim Crow, which some people have called American Apartheid. Basically, it was an attempt to really segregate the races, to put people in their places. And that even happened in some areas of the North, where even certain immigrant groups were told to know their place as well, like Italians and Hungarians and so on and so forth, Slavics. I'm here in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania, so those groups I mentioned were told to know their place as well. But, of course, with African Americans, it was more this type of rigid control and regimentation of a demographic was severe, most severe in the South. This turmoil continued into the World War I years, when labor recruits and so forth, and in Northern and Black people who were already living in the North, called upon Southern Black people, hey, there are jobs aplenty up North. Come North with jobs. World War I, booming economy. But East St. Louis was not suffering from interracial competition for jobs, as is usually portrayed. Most Black folks could only secure unskilled work, and there was plenty of that. East St. Louis long had a reputation for with this saying, if you can't get a job in East St. Louis, you can't get a job anywhere else. So something else was going on. And my thought was, whenever there's a so-called race riot, just like a lynching, something else was going on. What were the reasons for, let's say, a lynching or for mass racial violence? And so that was part of my research to dope it out. I'm not the first to look at this. Elliot Rudwig with East St. Louis Race Riot, his book in 1964, looked at it. But his thinking was it was basically interracial competition for jobs and for housing, with some degree of political concerns over reports of Black crime waves and so forth. Two other individuals who focused on the riots, Malcolm McLaughlin, he focused on, similar things, but he also stressed the armed self-defense. Harper Barnes, whose book on East St. Louis came out, maybe 2 months before mine. He too stressed commonly cited reasons, interracial competition for jobs and housing. I went into basically, the politics. But just to answer your question, the horrificness came from, wow, my God, it happened in the state of Illinois, the land of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. And Illinois, a northern state, although most people think of Chicago when they think of Illinois. But southern Illinois, where East St. Louis is located, is really a border state. It's like being in a border state, a border region between north and south. After all, Missouri, across the river, once was a slave labor state. So people forget there's that mixture of northern culture and southern culture writ large. We talk about the great migration of Black Southerners to the northern and midwestern industrial cities during World War I and after. But there was also a great migration of white Southerners. A historian recently talked about that, a great migration of white Southerners. Who's to say that maybe some, what percentage? No one knows. Any records were destroyed or disappeared through the ravages of time. But anyway, we don't know how what percentage of perhaps white Southerners engage in the pogrom.
This is a good time to ask you about this particular word, that you used in titling your book. You used an unusual word of European origin and experience. Why did you use that particular word?
Okay. When I started really reading about the newspaper accounts and so forth, my first thought was, well, being a child of the 60s, where I got used to hearing the word race riot when people go out there in the streets and so forth, and riot means basically people just aimlessly fighting or aimlessly doing this. They didn't have a coherent reason for doing what they're doing. They were just striking out in all sorts of directions. A riot. And they call it a race riot, which suggests that, okay, people of at least two different races were beating each other up, shooting at each other, whatever. Although the riots in the 1960s and after were definitely different from the race riots before the 1930s in this country. But anyway, I said, this is really different. This is really different. Now, other people, sociologists and historians in particular, noticed that the riots, let's say in the 1880s through the 1920s, were really like groups of people, in this case white civilians, invading black neighborhoods, attacking black folks, destroying houses, their homes, their businesses, so on and so forth. But it was still called a race riot. What makes a race riot different from the race riots back then, from the race riots of the 1960s to the present? Well, sociologists came up with, commodity riots and they came up with names like that. But as I was looking, at least in East St. Louis, the politics came in. The politics resonated to me. And politics were the reasons for the riot. And I vaguely knew, and of course I started doing readings about what happened to Jewish people, especially Jewish people, in Tsarist Russia. Because they're the ones who brought with them the word pogrom to the English-speaking world. Pogrom, which is Russian, for a thunderclap or lightning or something like that. I had some Russian-speaking friends who told me the word pogrom could be used for any group of people who became victims of this type of raging violence. Pogrom was designed to really target a specific community, defined as whatever, usually undesirable people defined by race. It could be defined by gender, it could be defined by ethnicity, nationality, whatever the group that is going to do the attacking will define the target in whatever manner possible to justify why they don't want this community to exist. So it was designed to disrupt, if not destroy, a community of people, a community deemed to be undesirable.
I just wanted to introduce to you and to the audience, our guest who's going to be sharing in this conversation. He is well known in human rights issues and struggles, and he's decided that this is going to be one of them. The idea of understanding, clearly understanding what this was about, and the obligation that we all have to memorialize it, to record it, and certainly to never forget it. He is the Reverend Dr. Randy Short. I had mentioned, it's amazing. You have people that you meet and you have interviews and so forth. And the minute it came to my attention, and he brought it to my attention that it was the 100th anniversary, I said, oh my goodness. Dr. Lumpkins, you had given us a lecture about 2 years ago or so. You did a very wonderful series on blacks and labor. And here's Randy Short, who I'd known in a different capacity, and you connected with this. So, thank you so much for being with us. You're on with Professor Charles Lumpkins. And we're talking about this incredible situation that somehow has managed to disappear from public view and from public knowledge. What is your interest in East St. Louis?
Hi, Dr. Schatz. I just want to say hi. And before I forget, I just want to make two brief things. One is that there is a Centennial Commission of East St. Louisans who are going to have a commemorations this weekend about the East St. Louis pogrom. In fact, there's a filmographer who interviewed me who decided, she's going to title it Pogrom, not Race Riot. The other thing is...
Well, actually, Dr. Short is part of that effort to memorialize this weekend.
He's going to be there?
Yes. This is what saying. It's just very strange how things happen.
Okay. And the other thing is, it helped me when I read an account by a person who was in charge of a Jewish social center in St. Louis, who went over the river to look at in the aftermath of the pogrom, and he basically said, this is a pogrom, and the Russian pogromists should learn a lesson from what was done in East St. Louis, because he thought what happened in East St. Louis was worse than what happened in other places, some places in Russia. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Randy
Schatz. Randy Schatz.
Yes.
Hi.
Now, your question to me was, why did it fall through a lacunae or a memory hole? And it's complex, but it's very, very simple. What happened there was so atrocious and so embarrassing internationally and diplomatically for the United States, and it impugned the character of supposedly our enlightened, Princeton-educated president, Woodrow Wilson. As well, it was very, very bad for the United States that's in Versailles and talking about world peace and bringing down the Huns for
making,
the Germans
the world
to be able to make wartime pay. Excuse me, if I'm going to speak, I'd like to not be interrupted.
Sorry. I was just enjoying it.
Yeah. It was embarrassing to the United States because the Germans and others mocked America because of this. That's one. The other issue is that the black community was in chaos in a certain way because of the movement, because of how that happened, the intensity, and because some of our more important leaders, Henry McNeil Turner had passed in 15, Booker T. Washington passed in 15, Robert Small passed in 15. There were no blacks in Congress from 1900, Congressman White from North Carolina, when he left, I believe, 1901. There were no blacks in Congress from 1902 until 1929. So there's absolutely, for the first time since Reconstruction, there's this huge gap where there's no real elected leadership for blacks across the country, in particular on the national level. So that's not there. The NAACP is in its nascent stages. The Urban League just got established a few years before. There was really no way to respond to that. Even the Garvey movement starts literally the year before, but doesn't become big until after the East St. Louis pogrom. So with all of this going on, with the war, with our Attorney General Mitchell Palmer, who's very repressive, this is unlikely. And then in the post or the civil rights era and beyond, the connection of the Democratic Party, both in St. Clair County, the National Democratic Committee, and the State Committee for Illinois, as well as the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the AF of L, Samuel Gompers, who's Jewish, who was involved in instigating conflicts between the workers to advance the AF of L. A lot of folks who were involved in the civil rights movement, at least at that point, that were aligned with blacks, this isn't the kind of story that's really that cool, although Elliot Rudwick has written one of the best works on it. This isn't the kind of thing you'd want. And for people who are looking to the Democratic Party as the savior, which African Americans have been doing since 1960, this isn't a very good light, because it's not just East St. Louis. It's Tulsa. It's Washington. It's Longview, Texas. It's Knoxville. It's Chicago. It's Philadelphia. All of these places with Democratic Party machines that played ethnic games for their own advancement. When things changed and they needed black votes, they changed their face. So who wants to go back and revisit history and recognize that the so-called party of civil rights was a party of lynching, slavery, segregation, massacres, and pogroms?
Agree. You took my thunder away. Thank you. I was going too slowly. Yeah. I was going too slowly, but that's where I was hoping to build up to it. Thank you. Thank you, Randy Schatz. Okay.
Well, here
I
is,
mean, because,
Randy,
because
so now you in your current was, situation, in the current situation that you are involved in, what is the aim here? You clear about the historicity of this event itself, and of course we know that it was repeated all over the United States, really. But I sense, in what you told me about it, I sensed that this is also a moment, a defining moment in African Americans basically claiming the moment psychologically and doing something to memorialize it, to record it, and to as I said before, just to claim the moment, which is something I think you might agree we are reluctant to do. We don't want to visit this kind of horrific past. We want to forget it. Why do you and others work now to memorialize it and claim it?
Because we are victors, not victims. The crime wasn't having a yellow star on or a tattoo. The crime was anti-Semitism and Nazism and hatred of the other. That's the crime. Not that we survived it, not that any people that have been persecuted or have been enslaved or exploited, that isn't the crime. The crime is what's been done against us. We are victors. And there is a lesson that people, even in spite of that, survived. There were people who were fighting. There were people sniping and shooting, fighting back, resisting, smuggling weapons across the Mississippi River to fight to help people evacuate. It wasn't just a walkover, even though they came at night, even though they came in greater numbers. Somebody lived to remember it. And as long as someone's walking around that can recount the story, we didn't lose. In fact, we have part of why East St. Louis is like it is because a lack of people having a memory. I told you yesterday I was at the Embassy of Belarus for their Independence Day party. And just to let you know that I have Jewish roots from Eastern Europe and Western Europe, even though I'm happily African-American. And to see how resilient people who went through the Nazis and the pogroms, I guess distant cousins somehow, they're made more powerful to say they didn't beat us. Look at all of what they did, and we're still here. And we're going to use the fact that we're strong people to build, not to bellyache. What I'd like, and what Mother Azima Kennedy Holt, the granddaughter of Lena Horne's cousin that died shortly after the fighting started, we want and we will have a committee for historical truth. You see, if you look at one community that has been able to take assaults and brutality against them and make it into a implement for empowerment and change, the Jewish community, I would rather us say never again than be in denial like we are right now. I kind of like the Jewish thing.
And so what we want is never again, no more East St. Louis's, no more Katrina's, no more Philando Castile's, no more assassinations of our leaders. We won't take it. And we're going to build, not so much on hatred, but build that why can't we feed ourselves? One of the things that they were after in East St. Louis was that they were voting as a bloc. They were demanding concessions, which we didn't even do with the black president in the White House. Huh? They were setting up businesses where we get our nails, our feet done by people from other countries that can't even speak our language. What did those people have that they were willing to fight for that we've probably let go of and we need to recapture? So I want some chutzpah in the hood.
Oh, my gosh. You're all in it. Chutzpah now. I'm making fun of you, Randy, but really,
yeah, that's okay.
I recognize what you're saying.
You know, we have to, I mean, what's the word? We get my sugar with oppression. We don't have to take it. Other people have shown you can be a minority and you can build, you can own, you can buy, you can be powerful. In fact, the fewer of us that there is, the more special we are versus, you know, it's like common spices. You can get salt and pepper for almost nothing, but go and try to get some Maurajam. Try to get something that's harder to find. It's more precious. It's how we perceive our past. If we see it as a curse, it is. If we see it as a blessing, then it's a springboard for us to be what we say we are. Do we believe it? Do we act on it? If you say I'm a king, are you acting like one? If I say you're a queen, do I treat you like one? Or do I talk about how someone else doesn't treat you like a queen or treat me like a king, and then I do the same thing?
So what is planned for the week of memorializing this tragedy?
Well, they do have a group that's doing several things. We're going to work together on the 2nd. We'll be on the Eads Bridge from about 6 o'clock until about 10. We'll be meeting. This is the 2nd. We'll be in the convention center, and I believe we're going to walk from the convention center to the bridge. We're going to have a very solemn occasion. We're going to release candles and other things and let a ribbon go into the river to commemorate those that didn't make it across that spiritual or physical bridge or river to safety. And then, of course, the 3rd day, and I'm going to go to the 1st day, we're going to be at St. Mark's Family Church near Ferguson, and we're going to have a panel including Cynthia McKinney. People from the Aurora Movement have been invited. I know Pam Africa and Rajakhan have been invited. I think they may be there. Cam Howard from Chicago, who's an expert on reparative justice. We have a filmmaker coming in from San Francisco. We have Marzia Hashemi from Press TV coming. Of course, there's me. We have Fred Hansen Jr. We've got a lot of people that will be talking. One of the things that we'll be doing is looking at rebuilding and a renaissance. Things that we want to talk about, aside from having a historical truth committee, we don't just want it in East St. Louis. We want it to go all over the country where these things have happened to reawaken people to the importance of knowing their history. When you've got hate groups infiltrating the police departments and killing and stabbing people, you know, the young man that got killed at the University of Maryland, I used to stand at the bus stop. I know one of the assistant heads of the Black Student Center that's literally across the street from where the boy was stabbed to death. I was supposed to go to College Park that day, and I was with the gentleman in the African American Rifle Association. I said, let's not go to College Park. It's racist out there. For an interview with 2 French reporters. And this guy got killed following morning, and the guy called me and says, you said it was bad. We need to take this all over the country. We need to also remind those who would say everything has changed, everything is wonderful. And my thing is, if everything has changed and it's wonderful, why hasn't Nancy Pelosi, why hasn't the Democratic State Committee for the state of Illinois, the Democratic National Committee, why haven't they in all these years apologized? why can't we get some apprenticeship jobs from the ACLU CIO? I'm saying not ACLU, but AFL-CIO. Forgive me.
Uh-huh.
I know the difference. Forgive me. I'm talking very fast because our time is short. Why can't we do that? Why can't we garden? Why can't we rebuild? Now, in reality, by reclaiming the past and acknowledging what happened, we have the ability to heal. A lot of Black people are broken. Broken people do broken things. They use drugs. They don't form families. They hurt one another. We have to acknowledge that we've been wounded and then treat the wound. And instead of wounding others, be a force against anyone being wounded.
Professor Lumpkins, the last time we talked, and we talked about race and politics and labor, and you did a marvelous job of taking us from era to era. Does it strike you as being significant that we ended literally talking about what was going on right across the river, and now we come back almost full circle talking about the same thing that had happened 100 years ago? I'm talking about Ferguson, Missouri, right across the river.
Right, right. Yeah, just like Randy Schatz mentioned about the Democratic Party, the Democratic, that's where I'm talking about the politics that was rooted in East St. Louis. It was the Democratic Party that really allowed the, or that instigated the fighting and the killing.
Yes, they did. In
East St. Louis. And now I don't want to repeat what Randy said. I mean, it was the Democratic Party all along. Somewhere along the way, African Americans made the Hobbesian choice, especially starting with the Great Depression. Survival with handouts from the Democratic Party and the federal government, or death, really, in exchange for votes from Black people. They did not get the political power to go along with it. Just like in East St. Louis, the Black residents there, the more active ones like Leroy Bundy, the dentist entrepreneur, Nora Patton, the assistant state's attorney general, who argued, the first Black person to argue a case before the United States Supreme Court, and others, were trying to build an independent Black political machine so that they could not only get their, what they consider their fair share and fair access to city resources and such, but also to participate in the governance in the city. And one of the things that happened in the immediate aftermath was to strip the, you talk about decapitation of Black leadership, that did take place in East St. Louis. Many of those folks, Leroy Bundy, Nora Patton, were stripped of their positions. Some of them were thrown in prison because they were considered instigators of the pogrom, of the race riot. They wanted a race war. They wanted to eliminate white people in the city. All these fantastic fantasy charges. And they push ahead with stringent, albeit de facto racial segregation of the city. Illinois had laws against segregation, but there were ways around it, and they found ways around that. They failed to turn East St. Louis into a sundown city, but they rigidly segregated that city. And now and then, there were reminders through city newspapers to Black East St. Louisans, I'll put it bluntly, don't get uppity, don't rock the boat, otherwise there will be a repeat of 1917. And I found statements repeating that theme up until really when Black East St. Louisians decided to go full steam ahead to desegregate the school system there in 1949. There was talk about, oh, there'll be another race riot, like 1917. So there were these constant reminders. Yes, it was
very traumatic.
Yes, sir.
There was a gentleman by the name of Angelo Brown who was shot in the head the 23rd of June last year in Belleville, Illinois, the sister city to East St. Louis, which is the county seat for St. Clair County.
Yes.
in Illinois.
Yes.
And they said it was a shootout, but no, it wasn't. They literally put the gun to his head, blew his brains out, fathered 15 kids. And that's never been in the news. Everybody that I know knows don't mess over in Belleville. In fact, the gentleman who shot up our Congress was from Belleville, Illinois,
sitting right next
to East St. Louis. And there it is, you have it again, a Democrat from St. Clair County killing people or trying
to. That's correct. Yes. For reasons, and there are many, convoluted, black people found themselves on the Democratic Party plantation. Especially, I mean, you know what Lyndon Johnson said in the aftermath of the enactment of the Voting Rights Act?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What did he say?
Huh?
What did he say?
We'll have the N-words for 100 years.
I mean, I read the pretty the sanitized version of what he said. The raw version was, we have these niggers voting for the Democratic Party for the next,
for 100 years.
And
also he said another thing: we're not really trying to help them; we're just trying to calm them down, and then we'll take these programs and such, which is exactly what happened with them. Even though he wasn't in office, I guess between Nixon's people and so forth, they phased out whatever looked like was going to be something that would change the situation for the people. This is the thing, going back, and like the professor was saying, the problem for me is the Democratic Party, and not only have black folks politically joined up with them, the churches that get the grants and the food and the special things have signed away their allegiance to God and righteousness, their commitment to tikkun olam, or whatever you want to call it, to heal and to look out for the poor and the needy, has been outsourced to them having 501c3. I call it 501 enslave me money from the state, city, and government. So nowadays, thanks to the Democratic Party, we can't even have Jesus, even if he is white, blonde hair, and blue-eyed.
You know, as we proceeded with this discussion today, all too short, in my opinion, it kind of occurred to me that this kind of conversation ought to be formalized so that it becomes a ready reference for people who are growing up in an age where they're not very close to their history. And it's not because, you know, they don't want to be. It's just the way it has been organized. And it would be a good thing, Randy and Charles, it would be a great thing to archive, as you proceed with the plans, especially Randy, to archive everything that is going to be done over this weekend and in the future, the immediate future, about recalling and memorializing, I used that word several times today, to create the first documentation from a people's point of view. I know, Dr. Lumpkins, you're a great researcher. This is your calling.
But the residents of East St. Louis
know that
have to
in trying to compile the stories, you probably went through several hours of just trying to find the location of recorded material, and you probably had quite a bit of a challenge trying to accumulate all this that you had and presented it in the form of a book. So this is a value too, that we can find ways to record these things which become historical documents. I just
want to mention one thing very quickly. The same Illinois Democratic Party that burnt the people in East St. Louis tried to burn the people out in Chicago in 1919, 2 years and 3 weeks to the day almost. And the dynasty that runs, the Daley dynasty,
has its origins in killing blacks and the dock wards of Chicago. So the very democratic machine where all these people getting shot and killed in Chicago, I'm not blaming any other community, but it's interesting that there's so much death, carnage, and redentrification and so forth happening in Chicago, and the same things are happening in Cairo, Illinois, and in other southern communities in southern Illinois, and it's the same party. The state is broke and bankrupt, and it's the same party.
Well, we talk about that very often here on this program. Dr. Lumpkins, I so want to thank you for being with us. And this is how funny things are, right? I didn't know that we would have this triad happening today. But it's just, it occurred to me that when Randy said that this was going to happen, I said, oh, we have a good person to talk about that. And indeed, we have. So I want to thank everyone for making serendipity happen.
Yes.
We all got together.
And since Randy's, you're from East St. Louis.
I'm from Washington, but in a nutshell, I had nightmares for years of a family suffering, watching someone dying on a raft in the Mississippi. And never made sense of this recurring nightmare until I read about East St. Louis. I thought that's crazy until I met Catherine Kennedy, who's the person I'm working with, telling her that I had this nightmare that had driven me crazy for years.
Yes,
and I told her I wish the dream would go away. I hate this dream, but it keeps coming back. And when I explained my dream to her, she said, you're not crazy. That's my grandmother in your dream.
Okay.
We'll have to leave it there for today because we are out of time. I want to thank you again, both, for being so valuable to our identities and our history today. I really am appreciative of it. We'll see you another time soon. Thank you all for listening. This is the end of the program, today's program. Please pass it on. It would be helpful for all concerned. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories, LEID stories @gmail.com. We'll see each other tomorrow. Thank you. Bye-bye.